All right, we are in the second part of Mark 14. We split that chapter. It's a long chapter. And because of the number of studies in this trimester, we did that. So here's where we are in our itinerary. Next week, we'll look at chapter 15, then chapter 16, and we are then done with Mark. Here's where we are in our outline. We are at the end of the book. In this last section, the events at Jerusalem, subdividing it as Stopher does, we are in the trial section. There's the teaching that primarily took place on Tuesday, and then there is the trial, and then there's the death, and then the resurrection. We get into the death next time. Let's review our chapters of where we've been. Chapter 1. All right. Beginning of this Galilean ministry. Chapter 2. Yeah, here's the conflict. Mark, as we have mentioned multiple times, I hope you're getting this concept, is a fast-paced writer where he just jumps right to the next point and skips some things. He's a fast-paced writer. And so he jumps right to this conflict. One of the conflicts, chapter 3, was, over the Sabbath healing. Chapter 4 jumps to the parables. Chapter 5. Three miracles, I heard someone say, yes. Chapter 6, John beheaded, yes. Chapter 14 of Matthew, dropped by way of comparison. Chapter 7, more controversy, eating with unwashed hands and more miracles. Chapter 8, Peter's confession. This is what Mark seems to be driving to, this point, to this conclusion, at least in the first 8 chapters. Chapter 9, Transfiguration, Matthew 17 and 18 is where, by comparison. Chapter 10, divorce and remarriage, Matthew 19. Chapter 11, triumphal entry. So by chapter 11, we are in ready to start this Passion Week, the last week in the life of Christ that we'll look at here in just a second. Chapter 12, something he taught on that. All right, the parable of the vine dressers, an exchange of questions that took place on Tuesday. And then on chapter 13, in chapter 13, destruction of Jerusalem. So what's chapter 14 about? His betrayal, his arrest, and the start of the trials. No one account, you'll see this if you don't already know this in a moment, no one account, by an account, I'm talking about whether Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, gives the complete story within itself of the trials. And we'll get to those trials here in just a second. So here's where we are in Passion Week, or the last week of the life of Christ. The shaded area is where we are in chapter 14. And if you weren't here last time and you are marking in the margin of your text what days of the week we are considering, at the beginning of chapter 14 would be on Thursday. That's the observance of the Passover, the farewell with the disciples, and then we have Gethsemane. If you want to drop down to verse 53 and mark to the margin of your text, is where we shift to Friday at the trials. And then we'll still be on that day for the crucifixion next week in chapter 15. Making sense? All right, that's where we are in our story. This is an outline of chapter 14, the betrayal, the arrest, and the trials. We've looked at part of that, and so we've looked at the plot to kill, the anointing at Bethany, and we're ready to pick up at verse 32, Jesus praying in the garden of Gethsemane. And then we'll look at his betrayal and his arrest in the garden. He will be before the Sanhedrin. That's the second hearing of 6 hearings, the second of 3 for the Jewish trial. Make all sense of that in a moment. And then there's Peter denying the Lord, as the Lord had predicted or prophesied would be a better wording of that. All right, let's look at verses, start right here, with verses 32 to 42, and this is the praying in the garden of Gethsemane. So verse 32 said, they came to a place which is named Gethsemane. And Luke's account in Luke 22 says it was at the Mount of Olives. And I believe it's John mentions it was across the brook Kidron. This is a map of Jerusalem here. And notice the scale of about, what, 2,000 feet. So we're looking at not a lot of distance. But Gethsemane is out here at the Mount of Olives, as we have talked recently about his coming into Jerusalem. But Gethsemane, or Mount of Olives, is in close proximity, just in walking distance of the walls of the city of Jerusalem. But what I want you to see here is that this was, according to the parallel accounts. Now, the parallel accounts, we're right down here at the second from the bottom. Matthew has a parallel account and Luke has a parallel account. John does not on this. But be that as it may, Jesus praying in the garden, what I want you to see is one of the parallel accounts mentions that this was a place where he was accustomed to going. So this would be familiar to all of his disciples, but it's also familiar with Judas. That's important, I think, in the flow of the context, that Judas would have known this is where he's going to go. This is where he'll spend time. This is where he'll be praying. This is where he'll be spending time with his disciples. He'll go to the Garden of Gethsemane. But be that as it may, verse 32 beginning, and we'll try to flag some parallel accounts as we go along, that he came to a place which is called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." Gives them a place to stay. And then he took with him who? Peter, James, and John. That's that inner circle. He seems to have a closer relationship with John. I'm convinced, though some are not, that the statements made in the Gospel of John about the disciple that Jesus loved, I think it just describes a closer relationship to John. And then here are the other two, that is Peter and James, are in that close inner circle. He loved all of his disciples, but here is a close inner circle, Peter, James, and John, who are often with him. But he takes them with him, and then notice the description of being troubled and deeply distressed, and in verse 34 says he is what? Exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. That's deep sorrow. So he's in deep agony. We're going to see more descriptions of that in a moment. Sweat drops his blood, etc. Deep agony a little bit later in some description. We'll get to that in a second. In Luke chapter 22. But I'm interested at this juncture at verse 34. He said to them, this is his not talking to God in his prayer, but he says to his disciples, Peter, James, and John, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch." What does that mean? Stay here and watch. Watch out for the coming threat. Needing to watch out for him to protect him. Watch out for themselves. What does it mean? You stay here and watch. I'm going over here. Do what? Lest you enter into temptation. It is true, he's missing and doesn't have the companionship here from his disciples. They all flee. But I think we must tie that. Let's talk about the word watch here, what it means. It means to be vigilant. It means to be alert. Pay attention. I don't think it gives the idea, y'all set guard, and one of you watch over this way, one of you watch over that way, And if something comes, y'all try to stop the threat. Because when Peter does try to stop the threat, he rebukes Peter. That's not what he's asking about. He's telling you need to be vigilant. You need to be alert. And he said, lest you enter into temptation. We see that at verse 38. So verse 38 is our explanation. Here's our commentary. Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. For the Spirit truly is ready, Matthew's account says willing, but the flesh is weak. We'll come back to that in a moment. But I'm concerned about your temptation. I'm concerned about your future trials. I want you to watch, look at my example. I want you to pay attention to what's going on that may help you in your future confrontation. Does that make sense? Because y'all are about to, when I'm gone, you're about to face some trials and tribulations. You're going to be put through the ringer. And you're going to be faced with strong temptation as you are here in the garden in a moment and at my trial in a moment. So you need to watch and you need to be praying lest you enter into, that you hold up through the pressures and the trials. So you say, I want to know what that means. Drop down to verse 38. There's your commentary. Verse 38. So you stay here and you watch. Did they understand that fully? I don't think so. Now, verse 35, he went a little further. How much further? Luke says he went a stone's throw. And so it wasn't very far. So we're not talking about a great distance. It's within a stone's throw. In other words, within sight, within a stone's throw, he went a little further and fell to the ground and he prayed, if it were possible, that this may pass. So what was his words in his prayer? Verse 36. Abba? What's Abba? It means Father. It's Aramaic for Father. Father, Father. All things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. He acknowledges God as being all-powerful. In other words, God could take this away, couldn't he? He has the power to. But I do not want you to exercise your power contrary to your will. You have all power. I want this taken away from me, but what I really want is your will to be done, even if that means my death. And then he came, and by the way, you might make a marginal note, it's at this point, according to Luke 22, that an angel came and ministered to him. Exactly what the angel may or may not have done, we'll talk about in Luke. But an angel came and ministered to him. And so we're going to leave that for our comments at Luke. Then he came to his disciples and he found them. Why are they sleeping? Think of a parallel account. If you've checked your parallel accounts, somebody tells us, for sorrow. Luke chapter 22, 45. They are sleeping for sorrow. Perhaps all of the emotion of all that has gone on, of what Jesus has told them. They're not comprehending everything, but he's talked to them about, I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer, I'm going to die. They don't get the picture fully. And yet they are overcome with sorrow to the point they're sleeping for sorrow. And he said to Peter, now this is interesting. There's Peter, James, and John. Why didn't he say, you three? All of them were sleeping, but he directs that at Peter. Now this is some conjecture, but reckon why he singled out Peter. Finish my sentence. Because Peter had boldly said he would never deny him. I'll even die for you. Remember that? That was just a few hours earlier. We're not talking about days earlier. We're talking about within the last few hours, he had just said, I will die for you. I will never forsake you. You're wrong about that. I will never do that. And he said to Peter, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? That had to sting. Could you not just take an hour and be careful and be alert and watch? Could you not do that? I see implied in that, aren't you the one said you would die for me? In your first trial, you failed because you didn't even watch for an hour. And so he again says, here's what I mean, here's what I want you to do. I want you to watch and pray lest you enter temptation. The spirit is ready, but the flesh is weak. Let's go to question number 7. What does that mean? All right, our mind wants to do something, our physical bodies don't do what our mind wants to do. All right, good point. Yeah, very good. There's a difference in knowing what I ought to do and in carrying through with what I know I ought to do. I know I ought to behave this way, but my temptation It has something to do with temptation, does it not? Look at verse 38. Pray that you enter not into temptation. And on the heels of that, he said, the spirit is ready or willing, but the flesh is weak. You know what you ought to do, but we don't always do what we know we ought to do. You knew what you should be doing. You should be watching and praying. But the flesh indeed is weak. Any other comments on question 7? All right, there's more explanation of that. Maybe not explanation, but illustration of that in the context before we get through. Now, Luke 22 adds at this point, for what it's worth to you, at verse 44, that he was in agony and sweat drops as blood were falling to the ground. So this is not a matter that Jesus went over here and prayed and then he's rebuking his disciples and he goes back and he prays again. But he is in agony and sweat drops as blood are falling to the ground. And so he went again, verse 39, and he prayed the same words. And then he returned and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. And this is interesting. They did not know what to answer him. What do you make of that? They did not know what to answer him. What does that mean? What's that talking about? All right, they may not realize that. Do you take it in this same context where the rebuke of verse 37, why are you sleeping? And could you not watch with me 1 hour? And he comes back and he finds them the second time. You'd think the next time he come back, they'd be wide awake and alert. We can stay awake, we can do what he says, and they're sleeping again. And he comes back a third time, and what does he find? He's still sleeping and resting. And he must have, though not mentioned here, he must have asked them again about their sleeping. Could you not watch with me 1 hour? And they have no defense. In other words, if you ever got caught doing something, maybe not sinful, but something you shouldn't have been doing, and when asked about it, you just, I don't know what to say because I have no defense. And they did not know what to answer him. That's interesting to me. The rebuke. And then he came the third time. Now, verse 41 implies he prayed three times, and we know that from Matthew, prayed the same prayer three times, and then he finally says, the time is at hand, let's go. All right. any questions or comments on that section before we go further? Question 8, what do we learn about prayer quickly from that context? Yes, good point. If Jesus needed to repeat the same words again and again, and that wasn't any violation of the will of God, then I may be need to do the same thing. Not a thing wrong with me praying this prayer and then a few moments later praying the same prayer again. Say, well, didn't God hear you? Well, ask the same question about Jesus. Did God not hear him? All right, what else do you learn? These don't seem like lengthy prayers, do they? Absolutely. If it's important, you may go more than once about the same matter, the same day, the same hour. Prayers don't have to be long to be effective, do they? To the point. He had one thing on his mind, and he prayed about that, and he prayed about that again, and he prayed about that again. Anything else? Question number 8. Sometimes our prayers are just focused on one concept for the moment because of what's on our mind. All right, let's go to the betrayal. Starting at verse, let me back up a little bit. Verse 43 through verse 52, actually, in this context. Parallel accounts in Matthew and in Luke is where we are. John doesn't have anything about this. So we have the betrayal and the arrest in the garden. Let's see what happens in this context. And while they were speaking, the text says Judas came with the 12. He would have known where to find Jesus. He's there with the others, but with three of the disciples. What do they bring with them? With the the multitude that comes. They come with, parallel accounts say they brought torches in, so it's dark. They bring torches in and they bring swords and clubs. And the betrayer, who is Judas, had given the signal, the one whom I kiss, he's the one, take him and lead him away safely, the New King James says. Mark is the only one that mentions that. The parallel accounts do not say a thing about that. I say they don't. Matthew says, records that he said, seize him. I think that is the parallel account to that. Taking him away safely, if that's the only record we had, it sounds like he's saying, take him away and do so safely. Don't do anything harm. He don't care. The idea of him safely, take him out under guard, the English Standard. Some of you use that. In other words, don't let him escape. Judas is worried about getting his money. I betrayed him and make sure he gets to the people that want him, or I may not get my money. I know there's some conjecture there, but I think that's true, that he's saying, take him away, take him away securely. Don't let him escape. Tells you his devotion to the Lord, doesn't it? And so he came and he said, Rabbi, Rabbi, and he kissed him. Now you think about, it's one thing to stand off and say, I'm against him, there he is, y'all go get him, but I'll go up and embrace him and I will show affection for him and show allegiance to him, and the one I kiss, that's the one. But now, let's add some information. He had already in John 18, before the kiss, identified himself, because they asked him that we're looking for Jesus and of Nazareth, and he said, I am he. They ask him again, he said, I'm he. Then Judas comes and kisses him. So he'd already been identified by himself in John 18, the parallel account to that. Now, let's see what else we have here. Verse 46. They laid their hands on him and took him away, and then one of them drew his sword, verse 47. Who is that? That's Peter, John 18, 10. And the servant's name, the high priest's servant's name was Malchus, John 18 tells us that. Now, Jesus doesn't, we don't have any rebuke of that. So let's add a couple of thoughts here in the margin if you want to do that. Jesus rebuked Peter in Matthew's account and in John's account. What did he say to Peter? Peter took the sword and cut off the ear of this servant of the high priest, and Peter is rebuked. What did the Lord say? Put your sword away. Anything else? Look at Matthew 26 if you see anything there. He said it, verse 52, put the sword in its place, put it away, for those who take the sword will perish by the sword. And do you not think that I could call 12 legions of angels? In other words, if I wanted to escape and I needed some help, I could call on God and I could get out of here. That's not what we're doing here. So put your sword away. Second thing happened about this cutting the ear off. What else did Jesus do? Luke tells us this in Luke 22. He healed the ear. Now, isn't that interesting? They're going to take him away and kill him after one of the servant's ear has been cut off, not just injured, but he puts it back and heals it. You would think that'd make them think, whoa, wait a minute. Wait just a minute. Look at the miracle doesn't matter. They're ready to move forward. All right. And then he says at verse 49 and 50, what does he say? This is a rebuke to the crowd that came. I was with you daily in the temple, and you never seized me there, and you had opportunity to take me, and you come out like you're coming out for a robber, like I'm going to try to escape, but that it might be fulfilled. That's a good question, what that's talking about. He doesn't quote a direct scripture. So before we get to verse 50, but that the scriptures might be fulfilled. Two or three things. One is that had to sting them. What you're doing is fulfilling Old Testament prophecy. They didn't want to do that. So what scriptures are we talking about? Well, it may be John 18, verse 9 and 10, that it might be fulfilled. Of those whom you gave me, I have lost none. That's not, we don't have a record of exactly where that came from, but that was some Old Testament prophecy. So that may be the one that we're talking about. Others think that this is just general Old Testament prophecies, Isaiah 53, Psalm 52, Isaiah 9, any passage that talks about the coming of the Messiah. But you are fulfilling that which is found in scriptures. Then verse 50. What happens in verse 50? The disciples all fled. They all fled. They left him. They're not going to stand and defend him. They're not going to stand and say, if you're taking him because of his claims, then take me too. I'm with him. They all fled. They all scattered. Now, there's a little story given in verse 51 and 52 of a certain young man. Only Mark records this. No other writer mentions this. So who was this? Many think it was Mark himself. Why do they think that? Because it doesn't seem to have much to do with the flow, and that Mark may have mentioned it because it was him. Mark's mother lived in Jerusalem and would have been in close proximity. The house may explain why there was a certain young man who followed him, having linen clothes thrown around his naked body. So why would that be? Perhaps got up from lounging or from being in bed when he hears what's going on and goes to see what's happening with Jesus. Conjecture? Absolutely. We don't know for sure. But the young men laid hold on him, and when they did, this reminds us of Genesis 39, a different circumstance. When they try to grab him, they end up with the linen cloth, and he escapes, and he's gone, and he fled. If that is Mark, I think Mark is saying, I was one of those that got away and fled when they were trying to seize Jesus. All right, let's go further now. Let's talk about... Well, I got ahead of myself here. Let's talk about him being before the Sanhedrin. And this is verses 53 through 65. Now, this won't take us long to cover this because I want to cover it in a broader picture, if that makes sense. The parallel accounts to that are all accounts. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all have something to say about this. Though not everyone says the same thing. I don't mean contradictory things. They just don't all give the same information. So let's see what we can find right here. You've seen this before. This is not new information, but I want to remind you that when we talk about the trial of Jesus, there was not just one trial. In other words, he didn't just go before a court. They tried him. It's over. There were two trials. There was a Jewish trial. They're the ones who want to kill him, but they can't execute without the Romans' approval, so we have to have a Roman trial. Make sense? And they consisted of three hearings each. So when you read about him being on trial, we've got to kind of figure this out. Is this talking about the first hearing, the second hearing, the third hearing, or is this the Roman hearings? So which trial is it? So let's run through this, see if we can make some sense, and we'll plug Mark in when we get there. So we start off with this Jewish trial, and they rush him off to Annas, who was the former high priest. He's not the current high priest. They think they've got him on the side. Only John talks about this. So they rush him off over there, and he asks some questions, and we'll get to that later. And he asked Jesus some questions, and Jesus said, if I've done any evil, what evidence? And he was struck, and it was just kind of a sham of a hearing. But he has no official voice. So they got to rush him off from there to Caiaphas, the current high priest, and the Sanhedrin. And notice this is thought to be between 2 and 4 a.m. They don't have any official voice till daylight or till the next day. So this is a sham of a hearing. So let's stop right here. And you notice Mark, this is where Mark fits in. So if you want to make a marginal note, this is the second of the Jewish hearings. This is a Jewish trial. This is the second hearing. They've been before Annas, now before Caiaphas. So, basically, this is a summary. These 8 points is a summary of the two accounts. They provided some false testimony about the temple. Caiaphas said, what response do you have? Jesus was silent. Caiaphas asked, are you the Son of God? He said, yes. Caiaphas said, well, that's blasphemy. We don't need any more witness. Turns to the crowd, what do you think? They say he's worthy of death. So they blindfold him and spat on him and beat him and struck him. And that's all that happened. Make sense? So let's see how that plugs in with our text here. Starting at verse 53, they led him away to the high priest. That's not Annas. This is Caiaphas. And Peter followed at a distance. That's interesting. That's a story within itself. Matthew's account said he wanted to see what would happen. He knew what was going to happen. He should have known what was going to happen. Why should he have known? He was already told. They're going to put him to death. He should have known, but he wanted to see the end, Matthew's account said. Anyway. Now, look at verse 55. The chief priests sought counsel against him that they might put him to death and found none. Notice they've got their conclusion before they've got their evidence. And they're looking for some evidence to support their conclusion. Do we ever do that? You ever have it out for somebody? I want to condemn them. I don't know what I'm going to condemn them on, but I'm looking for the evidence to condemn them because I'm against them. They were against Jesus. Now we're looking for evidence. So they found some false testimony, verse 56, but even that didn't agree. So this wasn't a very well-prepared trial. So the first charge was, in verse 57 and 58, which was what? He said he would destroy the temple and build it again in 3 days. Did he say that? Not that exactly. He did say, destroy the temple and I will build it again in 3 days. John 2. He wasn't talking about the literal temple. He was talking about the temple of his body. In other words, you kill me and I'll raise it again in 3 days. It was a prophecy of the resurrection. But they took it and said, he's going to tear this temple down and he's going to build it again in 3 days. And that's, this guy's crazy. But even then, their testimony didn't agree. They're in disarray. And so 60 and 61, Jesus was silent. He didn't answer anything. So now Caiaphas asked him at verse 61b, are you the Son of the Blessed? In other words, are you the Son of God? And Jesus' answer was, I am. And he adds this point, you'll see him sitting at the right hand of God in heaven. You're going to see that. You're going to see the power come because I'm the Son of God. I'm paraphrasing. So then the high priest tore his clothing. What need we of any further witness? So he turns to the crowd, as we've already mentioned here. This is blasphemy. What do you think? They say he's worthy of death. So then they abused him, and what'd they do? They spit on him, blindfolded him, and they struck him. I'm going to skip the prophecy because I'm coming back. Struck him with the palm of their hands. And then they said, prophesy. Now, what's not mentioned here that Matthew tells us is, in Matthew 26, 68, prophesy. In other words, if you're full of prophecy, tell us who struck you. They blindfold him and tell us which one of us did that. Could he have done it? Sure he could. He could have struck him dead for that matter. But that's the second hearing. Does that make sense? All right. Now, let's get ahead of ourselves. To go to, and we won't talk about this, but next week we'll get into Mark 15, and that's the Sanhedrin official meeting in the early hours of the morning. Make sense? We get to that in the next chapter. That continues on then, and we're now ready for the Roman trial, so they take him to Pilate. That's in Mark 15. And then he sends him over to Herod Antipas, and only Luke mentions that, and then he sends him back to Pilate. And that's the end of the trial. And then they lead him away to be crucified. So of the six hearings, Mark only mentions three. Does that make sense? And we've only seen one today. The other two are next week. Making sense? How that plugs in? We need to plug Mark in where he fits. And that's where he fits. Now, let's get the last section here. And that is the denial of Peter. So we've got time to work through this because this is... Not unfamiliar territory. So Peter was below in the courtyard. Remember, he's already followed at a distance. Now get the picture. He made this bold claim just hours before, and then he couldn't even stay awake for an hour. And Jesus comes back and he still couldn't stay awake. He comes back again, he still can't stay awake. And now they've rushed him through these hearings. By the next morning, or in the midst of this trial, a woman comes to him, and what does she say to him? Verse 67. You were with Jesus of Nazareth. So here's number one, verse 68. He denied it, saying, I don't know nor understand what you're saying. He's lying. And he went out on the porch, and what happened now? Rooster crowed. What did the Lord say about the rooster? Before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times. That's once. That should have been a warning right there. That should have been a warning. I remember the Lord saying something about a rooster and me denying, and there is a connection. He's slow to get it. Then a servant girl come, and she said, this one is one of them. Here's number two, verse 70. He denied it again. And then a little later, those who stood by said to Peter, surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean and your speech betrays you. Now let's add some information here from John, parallel account. By the way, between the second and third denial, Luke 22 says there was an hour between the second and third, for what that's worth. I don't know what that means to anybody. It just tells me a time element. The Lord must have thought we need to know that. But John 18 says that it was a relative of Malchus whose ear was cut off. So there was a relative there seeing all of that take place. And she spots Peter. This is the guy that cut his ear off. And she says to him, according to John's account, you were with him in the garden. And now we're ready for the third time. And the third time, verse 71, he began to curse and to swear, I don't know this man of whom you speak. And so now, verse 72, what happens? Rooster crowed, and now Peter remembers a little late. So flag verse 30 there. Remember over at verse 30, we flag verse 72. And over at verse 72, flag verse 30, those tie together. Because that's where Jesus said, before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times. Well, here we go. Verse 72. He remembered now. And when he remembered it, what did he do? He went out and he wept. How severely was his weeping? Anybody tell us? I mean, any parallel account tell us? Bitterly, yeah. Matthew's account says he went out and wept bitterly. In other words, it wasn't just like, oh, I messed up and cry a little bit. But I mean, he's weeping and he's wailing. And a little late, had his warnings. A little slow, but he wept bitterly. Make sense? Say again. Yeah. Do you think? Yeah, I think that's a very good point. The Spirit was willing here. He really wanted to do what's right, but the pressure was on and Peter couldn't hold up. Now, does Peter ever buckle again? Yeah, he does. He does. Galatians 2. Does he ever get the strength to hold on? Yeah, he does. He does. I preached on Peter one time, and one of the older sisters who's now passed on, she came out and made the comment. She said, once the Lord got Peter settled down, he turned out all right. I like that. Once he got him settled down, he turned out all right. We're going to stop right there.